All right, everybody, welcome to episode number 100 of the Three Drinks In podcast. I am your host, Vince. Over there, we got Phil.
Hey.
There's Phil. Phil's doing the intro. Very special episode. Nice round number.
Yeah, I haven't done the intro since you had a baby.
Yeah, which is a while ago now. A year and a half ago. So, do you ever think we get to 100?
No. No, not at all.
Well, we want to thank you guys for sticking with us all the way through. If you, I wanted to remind you, rather, that we are available on iTunes, Google Play, Stitcher, and TuneIn Radios. We were just on iTunes initially all those years ago. Now we're on all four of the popular podcasting broad network. I don't know. What do you call them? I have no idea. But that's where you can find us to listen to this. Just for search for Three Drinks In podcast, you'll easily find us. Hit that subscribe button so you never have to miss an episode. While you're there, leave us a rating and maybe even a review. We'd really appreciate that. On Twitter, we are at Three Drinks In Pod. That's at the number 3 Drinks In Pod. Three Drinks In Podcast on Instagram and Facebook. And any questions or concerns can be sent to threedrinksinpodcast@gmail.com. That's all that stuff. We're going to be talking about the movie Lady Bird today, and then probably just do a little bit of a recap of what's been going on since we started this whole thing. So anything else I should tease out here?
Well, that's all the good stuff.
Okay. Hit it, boys.
Did it.
Keep you on your toes.
Yeah.
You're light and nimble. Fast. Move like the night.
Well, I'm good like this now. I'm good with this now. It's only been 100 times we've done it. That's probably more.
Right.
All the screw ups.
You count the micro brews and the episodes that I was too drunk for us to put them on the internet or.
Yeah. There were the times we didn't have microphones really and we talked into the computer. Or didn't realize we were doing that.
We had the microphones. We just didn't know we weren't using them.
Yeah, they were practically props.
It was like a Muppet newsflash there for a while.
Yeah. Wait a minute. This isn't plugged into anything.
Somebody made a crack on Twitter the other day about all the guys getting nailed for sexual harassment. And someone said that by the end of this, the only guy left at PBS will be Big Bird. And I say, I don't know. My money's on Guy Smiley as the next one to go down.
Guy Smiley. Who knows what kind of hidden locks he had in his dressing rooms? He was always smiling.
Yeah, always. Yeah, that's normal, right? To have a button on the underside of your desk that locks people into your office.
Yeah, I've seen that in horror movies.
Yeah,
totally. Easy to install.
Yeah, so. That button is next to the button for the trap door.
That's be careful. You might send somebody the wrong way.
Yeah, I think Blofeld had the same button under his desk.
Yeah, like the one that knocks the Dr. Evil with the chairs.
Yeah, fall back, into the furnace. The pit of fire or whatever the hell they have down there. Yeah. The sharks with the laser beams.
Yeah.
Hey, Jonathan Schwartz just went down. That was bad news.
What, really?
Yeah.
Jonathan Schwartz.
My mother just told me this afternoon. It was 90-year-old FM, and I don't know what he did. It just, that's all I heard.
God, I couldn't stand that guy's voice anyway.
Oh, God. Did you play that that one KCRW podcast I told you to play from Rob Long?
No.
He was just like, I don't know where they get the idea. Where they're in a room and go, you know what this situation really needs to be sexier? My shriveled, naked body swinging gently in the breeze. My, sort of sagging, slightly pale endoskeleton draped over its shame. Like, what exactly? What happens to your shame gland that all of a sudden this becomes like You know, I got an idea. I know what's going to help this improve the mood here.
Yeah, that's not a Pandora's box I feel like opening. So
no,
it's nothing good is the answer. Nothing good.
What was good, on the other hand, was Lady Bird.
Yes, it was good. I was very happy.
Did you
I had to stick it out like forever to find it in the theaters. But anyway, what were you going
to
say?
No, I was saying, did you have to go back to YouTube to figure out how to pronounce this woman's name?
It's Saoirse, isn't it?
Saoirse.
Saoirse?
Yeah.
Ah.
Yeah. So it's as if it was Saoirse. Saoirse.
Oh, I didn't know that.
No. You were close, though. I mean, it was closer than I was. I said Saoirse the first time.
Yeah, our mother's Irish, so she will tell you later that it's still Saoirse because she pronounces everything incorrectly. But so don't argue with her. But
right. But
yeah, I had a hint. Otherwise, I would have just stared at it like I don't know what source. I don't know.
Sure. But yeah, you
good on her for not changing it.
Yeah, seriously. You had a hard time finding a theater. Our theater, for some reason, is still showing it, even though it's only 8 little tiny, like 40-seat theaters. And that's how, like, there's nothing happening because nothing wanted to open before Star Wars.
Yeah.
So everyone is just biding their time until the new year because there was just no way they were going to be able to do any business.
I mean, this has been out a few weeks now, but it was like very, very limited release. Like, you would have to go into New York City in some crappy theater to see it. And I didn't want to do that, you know?
Yeah.
I was like, please, hopefully this does well. So it'll come out, you know, to the suburbs and we can see it, but we had to wait a while. So.
Yeah. I think it opened initially in just 4 theaters, which is generally like Lincoln Center and yeah, like that. There's like 1 theater down on Houston.
That
does a lot of these, I'm looking right now. It's in almost 1,200 theaters.
Okay, it's pretty good.
Yeah, so this past week they gained 400 theaters from the week before. So yeah, they're picking up some steam, which is nice.
Yeah,
but did you know that the mom is the mom from Toy Story?
Yeah, it's Laurie Metcalf.
Yeah, I didn't like. I've slowly been kind of realizing. Like, I know she's Sheldon's mom from The Big Bang Theory. And apparently she was on Roseanne. She played Roseanne's sister. Like half the people on The Big Bang Theory were also once on Roseanne. I didn't, you know, I had no idea who she was besides just Sheldon's mom. She's been on a couple of Broadway shows recently, and she's been nominated for a Tony. She might have won, I don't recall. But she's very good.
Yeah, no, I thought everybody was very good.
Yeah. So you liked it. What'd you think of it overall?
I thought it was great. I really, really enjoyed this. And it was like me, 2 old women in the theater, and then an older woman and her mom, who was even older than her. And so the 5 of us just hung out and watched this movie, this coming-of-age story about a girl in Sacramento.
You and Methuselah's grandmother.
Yeah, it was pretty funny, but like the girl grows up in Sacramento and she graduates in 2003 from high school, which is when I graduated from high school. And
yes,
so I could relate to, I didn't grow up in Sacramento, but I related a lot to that kind of idea. And I thought it was really interesting. It was good. Despite having a very well-worn kind of girl growing up through a high school story, it held my attention. It didn't feel long, even though there were 800 little scenes that they sort of just stitched together.
There really were,
the entire life of the 1 year of this girl. And I thought the music was cute. Yeah, I really liked it.
Yeah. It's like there were times that I was kind of aware of the passage of time in the film, which is when I know it generally means I'm not having a good time or it's not a good movie. But this was sort of the exception to that, where like, and I couldn't quite put my finger on it until you just mentioned that there were a lot of small scenes because they cover so much of this girl's life. It's not a full calendar year, but it's a full school year essentially. From 2002 in the fall to 2003, I guess. Yeah, so it would be a full, because she goes off to college at the end. But and it doesn't have a traditional three act structure in the sense of like you meet the character and you know this is the setup and oh no something happens and then we have to deal with it and then we have the like, it. Yet there were very obvious sort of chunks to this story. Like the first third is you know getting to know the character, seeing how she interacts with the people that you know she you know naturally spends time with her. Chubby friend and the theater people, and then the third act, you know, she kind of morphs into, you know, dating the Marxist guy and hanging out with the cool kids, and then kind of getting over that and going back to, you know, where she really belonged and then going to college. So, like, it's there, but it's there's that's a lot to cover that you can't, it doesn't seem very obvious. Yet it works. Like, you're right. Like, you know, nothing is extraneous. Nothing sort of halts the movie. It just, everything keeps going and going. And you kind of know where you're going to end up. You know, it starts off with, you know, the fall auditions and ends up with the prom and then going to college. And you kind of have a very clear line as to where this story has to end up, which is, I think, what helps keep it moving and keeps your attention focused, is that there's no question mark as to what's going to happen. She's either going to go to one college or the other. We don't know, but that's where we're going.
Mm-hmm.
Exactly, you know. So,
yeah. The writing is really what's so great, because I was reading reviews and the only ones that were actually not fawning over the film were just like, well, it's kind of a well-worn story. In that,
yeah, my wife actually was like, "This is not new." I went, it's not.
It's not
exactly,
and that's fine. It doesn't have to be. Right. Just it's the way that you tell those stories, and that the detail and the care makes it very interesting.
Yeah,
you know, we get a very good sense of how the girl goes to high school. Like, she's in a normal school, a Catholic school. She has a chubby friend. You know, but they're not total outsiders. People know who they are. They're the weirdos.
Yeah, they have their own small clique.
They have their own. They have enough details that make them interesting, but not so many that like you're bogged down in stupid semantics.
Yeah,
you know, you see them in her room, let's say, like in her bedroom at home, and she has crap all over the walls, and she writes on the walls, and so you know she's kind of artsy and out there, but we don't have to sit there and stare at all the quotes that she wrote on the walls like she's some inner poet, like her inner poet and stuff like that. Like, I was so glad we didn't have to dwell on any of the stuff she did.
I think it's funny, you know, too, that, like, she wasn't very good at anything either.
Right. And, like, you know, you always have these, like, tortured, angsty teenage people that, are, like, write poetry and stuff, and you don't have to do that with her. She just has poetry on the walls. We don't know if it's good or bad. It's just that's what she does.
Right.
You know, and that's what most teenagers do. But we don't have to get that into it. We just need to know that she's kind of like most teenagers. Like, yeah, okay, fine.
The details aren't important. We don't, like, to go into that would belabor the point.
Right.
Yeah.
And I always think there was the scene where the two girls are sitting on the floor and they're eating the communion wafers before they're blessed. Yeah. Like, they sneak in and start eating them like crackers. And, like, the one really religious girl with the uptight glasses yells at them. But before she does, the two girls, the best friends, are sitting there, and they're talking about having orgasms and using vibrators. And it's cute, because they're not, like, overly graphic. It's just enough to let you know that these girls have sexuality in their lives.
Yeah.
And they can joke about it, but they're still kind of awkward and uncomfortable. And it's only, what, like, 2-3 minute scene? It's nothing.
It's very short, yeah.
You know, and that one stands out to me, obviously, because it's about sex. But every detail in the movie is that way, which is really nice.
Yeah.
Like the way that she doesn't believe in religion, but she's not doing it to be mean. She's just because she doesn't know what she's doing.
Yeah. The treatment of Catholics, I thought, was really sort of nice for a change for Hollywood. Like, you generally, you know, like with things like Spotlight from a couple of years ago, You know, the Catholic Church, I think you put it the best way, never fights back in these sort of arguments. They just, you know, whether they're right or wrong, they just take their licks and then move on because they're the Catholic Church. They've been around for a while. But most movies will, you know, kind of tend to hit you over the head with some kind of anti-Catholic message, which, if you want to make that point, fine. It's just not very interesting because it's talk about something being done 1,000 times before. But every opportunity they had to do that here, they didn't. You know, like the nun who runs the school is really nice and sweet and likes her a lot. We can get into the thing about the first priest who's like the show director, and then second priest who's like the JV football coach.
The football coach
who ends up taking over to and like, but like at the end he's like really like he's so proud of them at the end of the show. He's like, yeah, that was great, and he's just screaming.
Yeah,
you know, but yeah, they don't take any cheap shots, and it. But at the end, that's how she really connects back to, you know, her mom and to her home is through the church.
Yeah,
she goes to church in New York City, and that I thought that was great when she's wandering around trying to find something that she connects with, something that's familiar in her first few weeks in college, and she finds it in a Catholic church. When's the last time they made a movie like that, for Christ's sakes?
I know. And it's great in that is part of the entire movie. Is we're not taking any cheap shots or saying anything about anybody.
Yeah.
It's just this is a glimpse in the year of the life of this girl.
Yeah.
And it was nice. And I kept thinking back to who directed American Hustle?
David O. Russell.
Yeah, he did like The Fighter and all that stuff, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah. I hate those movies and I hate that guy. And this felt like one of those movies if it was excellent.
Yeah, stylistically, you're right. It has that, it's very abrupt in its editing, like a lot of quick cuts. And like the opening scene when they're riding in the car and they're crying over the grapes of wrath, and then all of a sudden they hate each other, and they're really, and then she jumps out of the moving car.
And her mother screams and it gets cut off real quick.
Yeah. Like I actually wish I hadn't seen that in a trailer because it was so jarring and like it just totally unexpected if you think of it. Like my wife jumped up, she's like, oh my God.
Yeah, like I hadn't seen that. So she's like, next thing you know, she jumps out. I'm like, oh, okay. But like in that guy's movies, he's trying to make all these statements and morals, and like everyone's horrible and everyone's desperately poor and everything is corrupt and this and that. And this wasn't like that. Everyone felt like a person.
Yeah, that's okay. What I was going to get to was that it was the realism, the honesty, whatever word you want to use in the depiction and both writing and the performance of these characters was astonishing.
Yeah. And that's good writing.
You know, like one of the times that hit home for me, and this is because we have a sort of a personal, you know, point of view with this, but the kid that she dates, the second kid, the really kind of like aloof.
reading Howard Zinn the whole time.
Howard Zinn and yeah. Noam Chomsky. And, you know, after they have sex and she thinks he's lost his virginity too, and he tells her in this incredibly cold way, no, you're like the sixth girl that I've had sex with.
Yeah.
And then she feels bad. She feels terrible. They get into a little fight, and then she leaves. And then when she leaves, she passes his father, who's asleep in a chair in the living room, and he's because he has cancer, and he's hooked up to the same oxygen tank that dad had before our father passed away of cancer. And it was like, wow, that kid's a real dick upstairs, and he treated her badly, but he has his own pile of crap he's the cool kid that's got it all figured out. He's actually in way worse shape than she is, probably.
Right, like, they were stereotypes, but not so much in that, because they all had enough dimension to them that you were like, oh, okay, they're real people.
Yeah.
You know, everybody has a thing. They're not cruel just because they're obstacles to this girl in her life. Yeah, you know, like the way they are in those other movies where bad things just happen to them because the plot has to happen.
Yeah, they're plot, in those films, they're plot devices and not people. And here they're people. Like, even the bitchy girl who becomes her friend, when she finds out that she's lied about where she lives, she shows up in her kitchen and she's like, I don't know that I want to be friends with you anymore. And that was sort of this thing, like, you know, it really shouldn't matter. Like, that girl in most movies, like in Mean Girls, that girl doesn't really care if you lie to her about where you live. She won't even understand it in a, you know, comedy about nothing but, you know, cliques in high school. But this girl, you know, had the realistic common sense to go, I don't know that I can, you know, trust you to be even a, you know, a casual acquaintance of mine, even though I think you're below me on the social totem pole, if you're going to lie about something as simple as where you live.
Yeah.
Which I thought was,
because in teenage girl world, you know, where you live isn't that as important as like how cool you are.
Yeah.
You know, like to us as adults and people watching a movie. Yeah. But we're not actually in the movie. Like they seem to inhabit their own actual world, which is how it really works.
Yeah.
You know, and the girl isn't really that poor. No, she's not eating, you know, drywall is what I'm saying.
Right.
When you see some movies where people are like, I'm so poor, it's either we eat tonight or we have to put a roof on the house because we're literally not, don't have a roof. We have right. four walls and a floor.
Right.
You know, they're just not as well off as they would like to be. The father lost a job. The mother works double shifts. You know, the brother doesn't really do anything but bag groceries. They took in another girl, like his girlfriend.
Yeah.
But she just feels poor because there are rich people around her.
Yeah, and the kid makes a crack about the tracks, which was funny.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, so.
I mean, you work in a Catholic high school. We won't say which one, but like, you know, it there can be disparity between people who send their kids there who, you know, who are of means and kids who are not. Like, there's, especially at a Catholic school, because charity is a large part of the Catholic faith. And so, you know, not every kid that goes to Catholic school is a millionaire, you know. Right. And, yeah, so that can be obvious. But even in this case, it's not the focus of everything. It's just simply the world that they live in.
Yeah.
So.
And it was very nice that, just the last thing about the writing was that there wasn't anything cheap, you know?
Yeah, I thought there was going to be at the end when the mom pulls away from the airport.
Oh my God, me too. I'm like, oh, if she gets hit by a fucking bus, I'm going to be so pissed. Because it would have ruined everything up to that point.
Yeah. I was like, oh no, don't tell me she gets into a car accident. Don't tell me. And no, it's just this gut-wrenching moment where she's, you know, you're watching her have this total reversal of like, what did I do for the last 2 months? I treated my daughter like crap and now she's leaving and she's gone. And yeah, like that was, it was heart wrenching.
You know, and that's the kind of, there wasn't anything like that. And when you watch them fight, if you've ever had a fight like that with someone that you actually care about, then you just know exactly what they're talking about.
Yeah.
You're just sitting like, yeah, I get this. I get that they actually love each other. They just don't know how to express it.
Yeah. And it seems to come out of nowhere too. Like at first I felt like, well, that's just like, they're going along fine. Then the mother said something incredibly callous and stupid. And, you know, I mean, the mother's just as much as fault as the daughter is, you know, and you find out why in the first third of the movie. She says, my mother was an abusive alcoholic. So she realizes she has no training in how to be a parent from her own parents. So how that she's not going to know what the hell to do with herself. And, you know, some of the fighting and the fights that they get into seem to come out of nowhere, and they feel kind of like by the time they get to one towards like the middle where, you know, they're yelling about, like, she's saying how your father felt really bad that he, you know, you wanted him to drop you off two blocks from school. And like, why? Like, it just kind of felt like, why are they fighting again? And go, oh, because they're mother and daughter. And that's what that's what people do. And it doesn't always follow like a scene's trajectory doesn't always have to, you know, make sense. And it's not random because they'd fought before. The whole movie began like that. Mm-hmm. And so it's consistent and it's sort of exhausting in its repetitiveness, but that exhaustion just goes to further on the you know, to explain the depth of their character.
Yeah. Well, their fights, sort of steer them in the directions that they choose to take. You know, like the more that the mother fights with the daughter, the more that she wants to get away and feels that she has to.
Right.
You know, like she wants to go to East Coast schools. And she keeps saying it's because, it's the artsy part of the culture, blah, blah, blah. She's terrible at the arts. And she knows as much. Like, yeah. She can't really act and sing, and she has no artistic ability. The real reason is she doesn't want to be near her mother anymore. And her town, of course, by extension, sucks. And so the more that the mom goads her, the more that she wants to leave.
Right.
And then once she gets there, she finds out, you know, I miss it and I needed it. It was a part of me that I can't replace.
Yeah. I like that scene, too, with the nun. You know? Where she says that she points out to her that she likes Sacramento a lot. And she's like, what are you talking about? Like, well, you write about it with such care. And you're like, you.
Yeah, the attention.
Yeah. And she says, well, I'm just paying attention. She's like, well, isn't that kind of the same thing? And it's actually, I don't think it is, but it's a large part of it, you know, being aware of what, you know, of the thing that you, a person or a place or an idea, you know, having an awareness of its multiple facets is a tremendous part of what being in love with some, you know, or it's the road to being in love with someone comes from paying attention to who they are.
Yeah.
Or a place too, with, you know, yeah.
And it's funny because, and I, you know, I sympathize with that in that I felt the exact same way in high school, which is silly. I mean, everybody feels that way, but we lived at the time, you know, 20 minutes away from New York City, the hub of the world, or one of them. It's not like we lived in some backwater in Arkansas. So I was like, I got to get out of here. This place is terrible. And, you know, now I'm an adult and I look back on it like, I was an idiot. I had all the opportunities at my fingers and I just didn't do them, you know. And she was not so far away from some cities. And also, she wasn't in another backwater burg either. She was in Sacramento.
Yeah.
And she doesn't understand. So, like, when she goes to college at the end of the movie and she tells the guy, I'm from Sacramento, and he can't hear her because of the music, he goes, where? And she thinks that he doesn't understand where she's from. So she says, San Francisco. There's only one Sacramento in America, as far as I can tell. Right. It's not like she said, you know, Springfield. You know? It's still her own insecurities and hangups. And not till the very end when she realizes maybe it wasn't so bad. I did actually care about it.
Yeah. And what's nice, too, about that moment when she realizes how important it was and she calls her mother and she says thank you for the first time, is that she doesn't go home, as far as we know.
Right.
Like, it's not this moment like, you know, I was wrong and I have to return. It's... You know, it's a very college thing to do, is to go to college and realize that your life wasn't pathetic before you got to college. And, you know, it informed every inch of who you are. Mm-hmm. And it was, you know, it was very important. But that doesn't mean I have to drop what I'm doing and go back there.
No, it like, struck me as like they both took very, very small steps towards realizing that.
Yeah.
And we just don't see the rest, because otherwise we'd be watching this girl the rest of her life. But, you know, like, it's the one thing that the mother and the daughter can't do the entire movie, is acknowledge the fact that they love one another and that they're not as unhappy as they act.
Right.
And once they can sort of make that leap a little bit, then they can start on that path. Not that they'll be any good at it either. But they try, is the point.
Right, yeah. Like, you don't get a sense that, like, okay, I'm done now and I'm ready to go out and beat. No, it's just like, I'm making progress. You know, she's inadvertently doing what, in that scene when they're shopping for prom dresses, which was, you know, it was one of the many gut punches this movie delivers. She says, do you like me, to her mother? And the mother says, and what was great about this reply was that it was so quick and natural. She says, of course I love you. Mm-hmm. As if she really didn't listen to what she said. And then she sticks her head out of the dressing room and goes, didn't say it. I'm paraphrasing. She goes, that's not what I said. I said, do you like me? And when she says, I want you to be the best version of you that you can be, which is both good and bad advice. at the same time. But that is what happens to her at the end of the movie. And she makes a little bit more progress to being that better person. Because you don't want to say to your kid, you're not done yet. They're not. But so somehow saying that just makes you feel inadequate. You know, like you're half formed, you know, for some reason. And then whose fault is that? And it puts a lot of pressure on you. So you can't say it to your kid, even though it's true. You have to do all this growing and maturing.
Anyway.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So.
Like all teenagers. They all think they know everything. Young whippersnappers.
But, that was one of the, that in the end, you know, I didn't get misty, but I was like, oh, wow. Yeah, that's, you know. Also, the you know what other scene really got me too? At the end of when they do the play, it's towards the, like, I guess the middle of the movie, they do Merrily We Roll Along. Uh-huh. By, it's a Stephen Sondheim musical that I don't know very well, but I do know that it's when he was doing a lot of cocaine, so the musical doesn't make a lot of sense from what I understand, and like nobody really kind of understands it. It's just, you know, more just Sondheim being Sondheim, and at the end everyone's filing out into the lobby of the school, and the priest who directed the show is sitting there.
Oh yeah,
and he's really depressed, and the girl. The heavyset girl goes over to talk to the teacher she has a crush on and meets his wife who's pregnant. And then so she kind of feels sad, and she sits next to the priest who's sad because his son passed away years ago. And, you know, you learn that, you know, through the kids secondhand. And then he looks down at the floor and says, they didn't get it.
Yeah. And it made me sit up. I was like, huh?
And what was really sad about that was two things. One, it's a high school musical, and so you probably shouldn't get that upset about people being obtuse about a high school musical. But two, it's this musical. Mm-hmm. So that's how deep in the weeds this guy is with himself, that he, you know, he didn't really understand what he was doing wasn't going to connect to anybody else. That's how isolated he was.
So wait. So he was upset that they didn't get it.
Right.
The people watching it.
Right.
Okay.
But nobody was going to get it, and he should have known that. He really wasn't aware that, you know, like, you can't ask high school kids to do a certain thing, and, you know, it's only going to be so good. And there was a lack of realism as to the expectations of the audience on the part of the... So it's just like, nobody gets this show. Mm-hmm. Why did you think that you were gonna, like, he's so depressed over that fact, when in reality he shouldn't probably pick that show, but B, don't be so upset about this. But that's how sad he is. Is that, like, this kind of thing where he kind of thinks everyone's with him with it, you know, like you follow me, and then nobody really is, and then you don't see him again until he's talking to the mother.
Yeah, well, he had depression.
Yeah, the thing that the kids say is that he used to be married and had a son, and the son died for some reason. I forget if they said how.
I think it was drugs or something.
Yeah, right? And then he, you know, divorced his wife and went into the priesthood. And, you know, they have that quick little acting lesson where it's like, okay, first one to cry wins, and he cries almost instantaneously.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, he was a really sad character.
So... I wasn't clear on it. Lady Bird, the daughter, finds pills in her bathroom because they all share one bathroom in the house. And they're the mother says that the father's pills. Your father's always suffered with depression. Was that a cover for the priest? Did she have the priest's pills, like, to give it to him on the side?
No.
No, that was the father's? Okay.
I mean, I took that to be honest. You know,
I just didn't know, because the priest doesn't come back, but the priest does go to the mother at the hospital and is like, please don't tell your daughter, but I need help with this that I'm suffering from.
Yeah, no, I think he takes a leave of absence from the school and, you know, checks himself into the mental hospital because he felt like he was going to hurt himself, I guess. And she asks him, do you have a support system? And he said, no. And I'm thinking, my God, you're a priest and you don't know anybody. Like, there's got to be someone you could talk to. Yeah. I guess he's isolated himself that much that even within a brotherhood, he doesn't, you know, didn't have anyone he could turn to when he really felt like he was going to hurt himself. So, oh my God. Oh, jeez. But yeah, as far as the dad goes, I think that was sort of the ironic thing about that is he was such a kind of happy-go-lucky guy and certainly the good cop in the relationship between the parents and Lady Bird.
Yeah, well, he would sort of shut down.
Right. That's...
Like, every time you'd watch them fight, he would turn away a little bit and, like, look down at the floor.
Yeah.
And I knew fathers like that because I would sit there and stare at them going, why aren't you jumping into the middle of this before your daughter kills your wife? And it's very awkward to physically be in the room with people like that.
Yeah.
Watching it at the same time, I'm like, yeah, this is exactly what it's like.
Yeah. No, it reminds me a little bit. It's a very Midwestern thing, I think.
He's not a bad guy.
No.
That's just sort of a little emasculated.
Yeah.
On his own. Like, not the wife didn't do it to him. It's just that's the way he is.
Sure. Strong, silent type, or just the kind of avoiding conflict kind of guy. I just heard a podcast with a woman named Ginger Z. She's the chief meteorologist for ABC. And she's married to a guy that I went to high school with. And she just wrote a book, which I thought was going to be like a silly fluff book, but it's not. Apparently, she's been battling depression her whole life.
Oh, it's not fluffy. No, okay.
No. And so she talked in this podcast promoting the book, and it was like a health and wellness podcast. And she was saying how, like, her parents didn't talk about things, and she didn't know how always to best express herself. Like, her father, you know, was a strong, silent type, and the mom would kind of fly off the handle without, you know, reason every now and again. And she goes, it's strange being married to my husband. Now, this guy, Ben, his parents are New York Jews, you know, and East Coast people don't have this long American tradition of the strong, silent male figure in a family. We, you know, Italian people, Irish people, Jewish people, we're very vocal about things that we're feeling and thinking. We don't let things sit. We get everything out, you know? And watching him, yeah, do that whole thing where you just kind of turn away and you don't get involved, you let them fight it out. We're not used to that because the culture that we grew up in, people expressed what they were feeling all the time, you know, which wasn't always the best thing, but it's better than shutting yourself down. So it's one of those things where, like, yeah, we you know, like you said, you encountered that with some of the people that you know, and it looks weird.
Yeah, it's very awkward.
You know, it's, you know, constantly fighting is bad, but,
yeah,
you know, constantly, you know, repressing all the thoughts you have because they might cause a fight or because, you know, you figure it'll just blow over is worse.
Right. So. And that's what happens in this one, in that he helps her go to college, financial aid, they refinance the house.
Refinance the house. That was like a two-second scene. I'm like, Jesus Christ. That's why the mother was so pissed at her.
Oh, sure.
Yeah.
Because they don't have a lot of money.
I think that's the thing that kind of, it doesn't get, I'm afraid people might see that and think that her anger was about, you know, that she's leaving to go far away. No, that's part of it, but not all of it.
That's not all of it. And they did it behind her back, too.
Yeah. Could you imagine refinancing your house behind your wife's back? That's insane.
Yeah. They made all those decisions without her. You know.
Which I have to say, I mean, that's the one thing about this movie that, I mean, I guess it's still very 2003 in a way, in that back then, which seems funny to say back then, but it was nearly 15 years ago, people really did believe that you absolutely 100%, no matter what, had to go to college. And people in 2017 are a little more wary of that. If basically you're doing is paying almost $500,000 to get, you know, a license to be a secretary. A bachelor's degree doesn't give you a whole lot anymore. And I don't know, people knew that back when we were going to college. And either that's something that's kind of dated about this movie or very true about this movie, or is just Hollywood blindness about the importance of college above all else and that you can't not go?
Well, it was just, you know, back then you had to go. You had to go to college. And she has those unrealistic expectations, and the guidance counselor laughs at her. Yeah. You know, like, you're not going to those places. Don't even try. And she, I'm just here to be realistic. You know, and everybody, that's what everybody thought you had to do. People still do it now. They're just not quite sure. No one's willing to take the risk really anymore. You know, like, I still hear people today, because I work in a high school, and it's like, well, you know, you don't, all the teachers are sitting around going, you know, you don't have to go to college. Meanwhile, all the kids are throwing themselves at colleges, at college fairs, at us teachers. Can you write me a recommendation? I mean, it's fucking December, and they're asking me to write them for the next year.
This is your first year teaching there, too. This is my first year.
You know? So as much as everyone says and talks about, well, you know, you don't really get that much anymore, it doesn't seem to matter. It doesn't seem to make a difference. No one's willing to sit there and take the risk and say, I'm going to be the first one that tells my son or daughter not to go to college.
Yeah, I think you're right. And the fact that you do still need it to get basic jobs.
Right. Because if everyone's going to do it and my kids are going to be the first one not to, well, it's tough to be the first one in that scenario.
Yeah, you got to have a really strong sort of like idea of what you're going to do next.
Right.
Yeah.
And but so back then in the movie, I mean, there wasn't even thought of. It was like, I have to go. Yeah. And she feels she has to go and far away.
Yeah, very far away. All the way to New York City.
New York City.
Do they ever say that she's going to NYU?
They don't say where she goes.
No, they don't.
Which I thought was nice. But they show you that she doesn't get into the nice ones.
Well,
she doesn't go to Cornell. Columbia.
But she's where she is at the end of the movie is NYU. I think she lived in the same dorm as my wife when she went to college. So it's very obvious that, like, that church is on Washington Square Park. Like, it's not even, you know, you do have to know a little bit about the geography of that part of Manhattan, but that's exactly where she is. She's not at City College. She's not anything else. That's where she is.
See, because, like, I didn't know that. And I've been to NYU a few times, but not enough to know that.
Yeah.
And so, like, as far as I could tell, I mean, she could have been any college in the city. And if you're not from the city, it all looks the same.
Yeah, I imagine it's not obvious, but it was blatantly obvious to me. I mean, I spent a year there.
Because I looked at it as like she got there because of her parents is what I took away from that. Huh. And I'm not saying like they did it all, because clearly she did enough to have the grades and everything, but it was made over. They made the point to say, you know, she's not an honor student. She doesn't do a lot. She didn't even know they had a drama school until the senior year.
Yeah.
She's not involved. What helped get her there? Good upbringing from her parents. They sacrificed a ton to get her there.
Yeah.
And that was the takeaway I got from
it. I mean, she's waitlisted, so it's not it wasn't a shoo-in.
Right.
But she does eventually get in. And she brings up the fact that, and this was very true, certainly for you too, that after 9/11, people did not send their children across the country to go to college. They didn't want them on planes. Mm-hmm. So that inundated, you know, areas with local applications. So anybody coming from across the country would be given a second look, because, you know, the geographic diversity was important to certain institutions, to say we have kids from all over the country who want to come here. Hmm. So that helped, I think, in addition to, you know, how her parents helped her both financially and, you know, developmentally.
Hmm.
So, but,
Laurie Metcalf is, do you enjoy the acting? Because, like, Laurie Metcalf is, like, born to play this stressed out mother with too much going on. Like, she's just perfect for that role.
Yeah, no, she was great. Everybody in the movie was great. Like, there really wasn't a sour note in the whole thing. I mean, I have to look up how to say her name again because I've forgotten. Saoirse Ronan was great, because, and I heard her described like this in reviews, and I agree, like, she's, you know, not cute or, you know, like adorable, but like her, like the honesty with which she's portrayed and the familiarity that I experienced with her as with girls I knew at that age kind of makes her a little bit endearing, even though she's clearly not, you know, trying to be endearing. Like nobody was trying to be anybody, you know, everything right. kind of flowed out of them, which was sort of nice. The dad was good. I didn't recognize Tracy Letts in this movie.
Was that him?
Yeah, he wrote August Osage County, which was pretty big. And he also wrote that I liked a lot. It was a play called Superior Donuts, mm-hmm. which if you recognize the title,
they had a show out of that, didn't they?
It is a sitcom now starring Judd Hirsch and some African American actor who's young and who I don't know. And it what's really funny about that was the play is not it's a comedy, but it's not a straight up sitcom comedy. It is about a kid who gets a job at a Chicago donut shop. And you know, it's a drama, you know, it's about race and people getting along. And it's been a long time since I've seen it, but it was, August Osage County was like a 4-hour, 2-intermission opus with 20 characters. It was the only time I've sat through anything that long. And when the lights come up, you go, oh, already? You know, it was weird because it was that good. But Superior Donuts was like a two-hander that was like an hour and a half. You know, it was the guy's like, I can do it. You know, he was going to kind of stretch his legs and write different things. But then they made it into a racially mixed matched sitcom on, what was that, CBS?
Match Comedy number 366.
Yeah, exactly. You know, but like the setting is the only thing. The setting and the white owner and the black guy working at the donut shop are the only thing that are the same about this. And I've never seen it, so I don't know how good it is. But I was like, that is they took that and ran with it, didn't they?
Okay, yeah, I can't remember if it's on NBC or Fox or something. But I've seen commercials. So I'm like, huh.
I want to say CBS because CBS has pretty much every half hour multi camera. Laugh tracks at the sitcom going. But he won a Tony, the guy who wrote those and then who was in this movie, Tracy Letts. He won a Tony, I think, last year or the year before. So he has a multifaceted talent. And I thought he was really good in this. I didn't recognize him, actually. He was one of those kind of blended into the background, which is what I guess the character was supposed to do also.
He was good at that.
Be part of the wallpaper almost. Mm-hmm. But I thought everyone, even her brother who didn't do much, still was good, and the gay kid was good, and the other boyfriend, like everybody was good. Did you happen to catch who the friend is?
Her chubby friend?
Yeah.
No.
That's Jonah Hill's sister.
Oh,
she looks just like him. If you go back and look at it, oh yeah,
I'll have to go back and look.
Yeah, apparently people have been calling her the female Jonah Hill, not knowing that.
Oh, really?
They're actually related to each other. Hmm. But she was good too, because she wasn't like, I loved the scene when she comes in at the, like, instead of going to the prom, she goes out like, and then she makes the kids take her to that girl's apartment, mm-hmm. and she's like. That was one of the more realistic scenes in the movie. If it was just the way that they came in, and she was upset and she was crying. Next thing you know, they're laughing and eating cheese, and then they're going to put on their dress and go to the prom anyway. And I'm like, yeah, that's what girls did.
Yeah, that was fine. And like, it was nice to see that they patched things up and not in like this awful way.
They didn't do anything. And that's also what girls do, is they don't actually have to have a big sort of like come to Jesus meeting with each other about everything. It's just like, oh my God, I'm sorry. And then that's it. And they move on.
Yeah.
Yeah. I was going to ask you a question that went right out of my fucking head. Damn, I hate when I did it.
It's like we're new with this.
Yeah. You think we have done 99 ones of these previously. Anything you didn't like about it? just to play devil's advocate after 48 minutes?
Not really. And I mean that in like a good way. Like I didn't really, nothing bothered me. I didn't feel bad. I was waiting for something bad to happen and never did. Like that like a car accident that didn't happen, stupid shit like that.
Well, let's talk about that for a second. Why are we, because we both had that exact same thought at the exact same moment in the movie. When, like, do you think that was accidental on the part of on the writer and the director that, were we supposed to feel that way at that moment? That, oh my God, something terrible is going to happen and she's going to leave and never get hit by a bus and never get the chance to tell her daughter she loves her kind of thing.
Yeah, because that's bad writing. And like, we're not used to seeing movies like this. So that when we do see it's, first of all, this is a good movie to start with, but we don't usually see artsy or movies like this. So that when you do see a movie that pretends to be artsy, it's not usually very good. Because it's hard to make good movies. So I know myself, I'm much more, I see those kinds of things more often where the emotional manipulation comes from bad writing. Well, let's just kill this mother now with a bad car accident, like City of Angels or something like that. Let's just kill the love interest. It's going to get a reaction out of me, but I'm more mature and I've seen enough movies now to know, like, to expect that bad sort of thing.
Yeah.
And I hate that. Yeah, I want to see something good.
There was a wonderful example of how terrible that can be, and I wish I could remember what it was. It was this novelist. She's the closest thing to a pulp novelist we have now. She writes all these books that are basically just emotionally manipulative. Where like it's called the name of the book is My Sister's Keeper. That's all. Those of you listening might know who I'm talking about, who wrote it. Basically, like, these parents have a kid and the kid has some kind of disease or a condition that requires a certain kind of, certain organs, and it's hard to find matches. And so they have another kid with the intention of raising that child to be an organ donor for the first child. And it's just, which is awful in and of itself.
What?
Yeah, yeah, no, it's just deplorable.
It's a hot ball of nonsense right there.
I mean, I don't know how you'd time that out, but okay.
I know.
There's some logistical issues with this. But basically, the second kid finds out the purpose of her being alive. I mean, getting past the science of it, it's actually a gut-wrenching kind of story. But it sort of feels like, as I want to have that reaction where it's like, what? That's ridiculous. But I don't. My reaction to that is, oh, that's crazy. Like, because that's all we get now are things where the situation is sort of bizarre, but it's so bizarre that we kind of expect and want sensational kind of stories. And at the end of this particular one, like, one of them gets hit by a bus, and like, I forget which one it is, but it's like it's a surprise and it's one of those shocking things. But it's every movie we get now, if it's not a comic book movie, it's an elongated episode of Grey's Anatomy where picks people to die to make people sad.
You don't want to watch a melodrama. If I wanted to watch Guiding Light, I would do that.
Yeah.
Whenever they need some sort of problem in that, somebody goes into a coma or comes out, or they fall down an elevator shaft, or secret baby that just appeared. I mean, stupid bullshit like that.
Can you say long lost triplets?
Yeah. Wedding after wedding after wedding. And I'd like to think I'm more sophisticated, despite all my Marvel movies that I watch, that I can recognize those things, and I don't like them. So when you have a movie like this that doesn't have that, even when I watched Whiplash, there's the moment where he gets hit by the car and he can't make the thing. He can't make the concert. And even that felt a little like, oh, he's going to get hit by a car now. And he runs all the way there covered in blood. I'm not saying that the guy wouldn't have done that. I'm just saying that was convenient to throw off his one chance or whatever it was. It was, and that's a great movie. I love that movie. Yeah. I'm not knocking that at all, but you know, this was a movie that didn't need anything like that, and it was all the better for it. It didn't need anything stupid like that.
And I think that's the right way to put it, is that it, like, Whiplash is a great story, but it is dramatic and highly dramatic in a lot of ways. Like, and it wouldn't function without that drama, because that's the whole point, is that the people in it are over the top and crazy. And
they need that.
Yeah, the central question of Whiplash is, can you be normal and a tremendous artist simultaneously? And the answer, I think, at the end of the movie is no. And that comes from Damien Chazelle's fascination and obsession with jazz. And everybody who's obsessed with jazz always feels the same way, is that, like, all the greats were crazy, therefore you need to be crazy to be great. And how do we explore that? You know, and so he, as a director, says, how do we explore this theme? This movie is kind of the opposite of that. Like, you can be good and be a little bit crazy, but, you know, like, thematically, in terms of the characters, like, you know, you don't have to be great. You can be good, and it'll still be wonderful. Mm-hmm. You know, it's not people marveling at the ordinary. It's people looking at the ordinary and finding that for them it is extraordinary, and then that is important to them. Have you read The Grapes of Wrath?
Yes.
Is there, like, I'm trying to think. There sounds like there's a connection, because Steinbeck was kind of, he's from California, right? Like, rural California.
Yeah. I think the connection, and I read this somewhere else, and I agree, is that, and it's not a heavy-handed thing, thank God. It's just that she's crying because those people are going through the Great Depression in that book, mm-hmm. and their entire lives are shattered because of it. And she feels that she has to go through something.
She says
to come out. Yeah, to come out the other side. And her mother goes, well, that's ridiculous. You don't have to do that, blah, blah, blah. And she's right. Like, you can have a regular, quote, quote, boring suburban life and still be a good person who does good things. And that's why I like this compared to, say, something like American Beauty, where, like, they eviscerate the suburb life as if it's this soul-crushing, eye-deadening thing, mm-hmm. which I take offense to now. Because I live in the suburbs, and I know plenty of people who aren't like that. But even at the time, I was like, I do not understand what the problem is with these people. You know?
Yeah.
Like, not everyone is this soulless drone because they don't live in a city, you know?
Yeah. People who hate that movie really, really hate it. And
I hate that movie.
Yeah. It's come up lately a lot, I think, because of Kevin Spacey and all the crazy sex allegations about him, and it's brought up a lot of his, you know, that's what he won the Oscar for that. And I wondered a little bit if, because I liked that movie a lot, and I haven't really watched it in a long time. And whenever I go back and look at it, I'm looking at the performances, and I'm looking at really the Sam Mendes's direction and the way that he can play with light and color in the frame. It's a very visual film. People forget that. But I wonder, you know, because that was new to me when I first saw it. I was 17. You know, I grew up in a suburb, very, you know, not a cookie cutter suburb like some places, but, you know, typical in the sense that all suburbs are inherently typical. And to me, it was new. It was like, oh, yeah, all right. I guess there is a little bit of a facade and, like, you know, but people who hate that movie really hammer home this whole idea that it was written by, you know, liberal elitists who live in urban areas, who look down upon middle America, and people who live just outside of their cities who emulate middle America in some capacity, and say that, you know, they scoff at them and say that you're pretending to be something that you are not. And in doing so, you are cheapening the fabric of our society. I didn't get any of that because I'd never heard those arguments before. If I watched that movie today, given everything I know about the world being 36 years old, yeah, I probably would have that reaction and go, this movie sucks. It's bullshit. It's nonsense. Yeah, but because I was 17 and it was 1999 when I saw it, I was like, wow, this is a fresh take for me. It just never occurred to me to think of, because I did know people who lived in a big house, or even not a big house, but a nice house and with a nice family. And it turns out that everybody hates each other. And dad is secretly banging his secretary. I knew people like that. So it wasn't like it was insane to me.
No.
But the overall social commentary.
Well, the social commentary that gets, I think people don't get is that, so like in this movie, in Lady Bird, excuse me, they talk about how, first of all, she's too young to understand that there are good things in her life in the suburbs that she's just not seeing and she can't appreciate yet. And she doesn't until she starts to move away from it. And there's others like that where, like, well, now that I'm older and I can understand and I get that what I've been looking for has been here all along. And okay. Versus American Beauty, which says that there isn't anything there at all. It's all fake. There isn't anything that you can possibly enjoy about this. We have to put on plastic smiles. And that I don't agree with that. I think that's wrong.
Yeah.
You know, not everyone's going to be happy. No. Will everybody find happiness? No. There is a happiness there for most people and what they look for it. And those sorts of movies like American Beauty just sort of like, well, you must be a dumb hick rube if you think that, or faking it. Like, well, those aren't the only options.
Well, so. You know who the only two happy people in the entire movie are?
In American Beauty?
Yeah.
No, I don't know.
The two gay guys. The two openly gay guys who are their neighbors.
Yeah.
And Alan Ball is a very openly gay man who's, you know, that's, I mean, and now,
okay.
his point might not be that it's because they're gay that they're happy. It's that they're open about their homosexuality, that they're happy.
Yeah, they're not hiding anything.
That they're not hiding, exactly. They're the only ones who are not hiding anything. Yeah. And it's, you know, but again, like, I think conservatives tend to read a lot into that movie too. And like, you could look at it, yeah, like, well, the gay writer writes about gay people as if they're the only happy people on the planet Earth, which maybe he did. I don't know, but I don't think so. I think he wrote it that they're the only ones who are being honest about who they are. And then just like, it's not a big deal. Like when those two guys show up at the Chris Cooper's house, and they drop off a little basket of, you know, like, welcome to the neighborhood. And Chris Cooper doesn't realize that they're gay and thinks that they're salesmen and says, well, you know, what's your deal? What do you do? And one guy says, he's a tax attorney and he's an anesthesiologist. They got to look at him like, what do you mean? Like, it doesn't even compute to the two guys. Like, what do you mean? What do we do? You know, why would you think we're not being honest about this? They're confused by his skepticism.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But other than that, I couldn't think of anything wrong with the movie, really. I really enjoyed it.
Yeah.
I was happy I enjoyed it. You know.
It's nice, right?
It is nice. I'm sorry that the episode isn't very funny. Not that I think I'm very funny, but it's hard to be funny when you actually really like the movie.
Yeah.
Yeah. You know.
We'll save the funny for our 45th anniversary, revisit of Bloodsport in a couple of months.
Yeah. Oh my God. We need booze for that one.
Honestly, I actually watched the first 20 minutes of that movie today. I'm like, there's a movie in this today. You could make this movie. It's like the situation's not ridiculous. But like, you go back and you look at how kind of slapdash it was put together by Canon International Films.
Say slapdash. Whoa.
It's made for $48 and a waffle. But like, Forrest Whitaker's in this movie. Like, you know.
He was also in Battlefield Earth, so let's not go crazy.
Hey, everyone's money is green, man.
Yeah.
So one thing I noticed about this movie was that
cash is just as good as money, man.
Forrest Whitaker is so talented that it's hard for him not to make other people look bad. And so he plays like a army cop or something like this, a plainclothes guy is hunting down the main character played by Jean-Claude Van Damme. And he has an older partner, so it's like the young, you know, black, you know, cop and the older white cop. And the older white cop is such a bad actor that it sort of makes Forrest Whitaker look ridiculous. Like, dude, what are you doing here? Did you wander into the wrong movie? Were you supposed to be over there making Good Morning Vietnam and they just, you know, they just settled you into this?
No, I thought you were watching the monitor and watching me. You're actually in this scene. I'm sorry. I didn't realize that.
Yeah. But anyway, we'll
so you'd recommend this movie, I assume?
I would. I wish we could see more movies like this. And I can't tell if the reason that we don't is because, I mean, they're not making them. Are they not making them because they're too hard to make? Which is an entirely understandable point of view. Or is you know, what is it more? That they don't want to make them or that they're too hard to make?
I don't think they want to make them.
Okay.
This is out there. Star Wars comes out this weekend. Star Wars number 500. So, like, it's going to get crushed by Star Wars. It's been out a few weeks, yes, but it's going to get crushed and disappear, and the lucky few like us who saw it will be able to tell people about it. But they're hard to make and they're hard to market, you know?
Yeah, I mean, one of the things that came up a lot in the wake of the Harvey Weinstein revelations was that, you know, people, you know, were disgusted by it. Understandably so, it is disgusting. But they were saying, like, how did this guy get by for so long doing this? All he did was make weirdo indie movies. Like, he didn't make... Like he's not a Brian, you know, a Grazer or a Glazer. He's not a Kathleen Kennedy who's making Star Wars movies. He's, you know, he's not even a Tim Burton. Who's he made art house movies, but he made art house movies viable again. Whereas, you know, before, like in 1980, it was between E.T. and Gandhi for Best Picture. And everyone thought that E.T. was going to win because it was so popular. And Gandhi won, and everyone's like, huh, that's weird. It wasn't like no one saw that movie. And then thus began a trend for giving the Best Picture Oscar, the real critical acclaim, to movies that nobody had seen before. And like they make jokes about it at the Oscars every year. I think Viggo Mortensen was in a movie this past year or the year before that literally 8 people saw, and he was up for Best Actor. But like this is what Harvey Weinstein did, was he took these movies like Lady Bird, made independently for maybe $5-6 million, and made them not necessarily financially successful films in their own right, but critically very successful. And then the people in the movies would go off and make on their own a butt ton of money, and he would get a little bit of the 200 movies he produced every year and amass a fortune that way. So he made out, and the people in the movies made out, you know, but the movies themselves don't make a ton like Star Wars is going to make. So my point is, there's a market there for this kind of thing, and Harvey Weinstein happened to find it and sold these movies pretty well. Why is it that there aren't more, I hate this is an odd expression, more Harvey Weinsteins, more guys willing to take a look at art house movies and say, these are good films. Will they make $200 million in their first 48 hours of release? No. But we don't want them to. We don't need them to. They didn't cost that much to begin with.
Because I think they're hard to make. Like this one is good. Very good. But, you know, like I said before, I've seen way more crappy movies that just aren't that good. And people don't want to waste. And I saw it on a Tuesday, so it was $7. If I had gone the next day, it would have been $17. And I'm not going to take the chance like that when I know I can go see something like Star Wars where my eyeballs can just sort of melt for 2 hours, you know, just make it easy on me. Well, I know this will probably be okay. You know, shrug. Or I'll just wait till it's out on video, which is a thing now, especially. Like, if I hadn't seen this movie, I could just wait. But it wouldn't get made. You know, a lot of these people, things don't get made that way. Mm-hmm. If you don't pay for it in the theater, well, then I can't afford $5-6 million and then put it on streaming devices.
So what you're saying basically is this, that we are so risk-averse a culture when it comes to our entertainment, both from the point of view of the people making the movies and the point of view of people paying to go see them, that people making them would rather make $200 million movies and have one of them do $1 billion in sales, basically evening out, than they would make 15 to 25 low budget $25 million pictures to have a couple of them, you know, do pretty well, and all of them make back about what they, you know, break even eventually, and then yet have a couple just soar in terms of critical acclaim.
Yeah, I mean, I think that's come up a few times on here on the podcast. You know, that's why we have 5 Transformer movies. It's true, and we don't have a lot of these kinds of movies. Sadly for us.
I mean, we are ignoring
most people don't care.
Yeah, they don't really care. I mean, we are also ignoring a little bit about the overseas market, which is, you know, like China, you know, is financing most of these movies now anyway. Alibaba Films, which I think is really funny. That's the name of a Chinese company.
1 billion Chinese people aren't going to want to see this movie. Some of them might, but a lot of them won't.
Maybe 8.
Yeah. let's say 6. I don't want to oversell it.
It's not go crazy here. 6 would be fine.
Yeah.
So, all right. 100 in the can.
Yep. See ya.
Feel good?
Just kidding. No. I mean, we can keep talking. I just
ready for the second 200 or the second 100.
Yeah, let's do it. So, we got 40 more Star Wars movies to watch. So,
coming up on our annual Star Wars holiday special.
Yeah, that's a thing. Episode 101, probably.
Yeah,
I know. It'll be good. Another 100 episodes.
You know,
I remember, like, hey, you want to do that? Like, we were in the sushi restaurant.
Yeah.
It's like, we could do a podcast. That's easy.
That's not so hard. Why don't we just pretend to have guests and they never show up? That's a brilliant idea.
I'll take 5 more of these. Yes, thank you. Whatever they are.
Sake!
Yeah. It was BYOB, that place.
That's true. We were drinking our own beer.
We did bring our... We BYO'd.
I actually like that about New Jersey. I wish the food was better in those places, but like, I like that you can just show up with like 3 or 4 bottles of wine at a Italian restaurant.
Worked out fine for us.
Like, really good one that you paid $9 for, then order a bowl of pasta and just sit there forever.
You know, and all the however many listeners we have, worked out well for them. So
yeah, we really appreciate you guys, and I know that we, I mean me, rattle on all the time about like go to iTunes and rate us and everything like that. But you know, you should still do that. But even if you don't, we still appreciate it for the fact that you listened, because we did not expect to have anybody listening. And
no.
You know, at last count, it was you know, almost 200 people who were actively subscribed. That doesn't count people who just, you know, listen to us on a whim. So,
And then there wasn't any idea of that when we started. It was like, well, we're doing this anyway.
Yeah, we were
like,
we're just having conversations, you know, sitting there playing Call of Duty or, you know, watching Star Trek or whatever. Like, you know what I think about this? And then you'd say something. You know,
might as well just stick microphones in our faces and do it.
So this is obviously fascinating. So,
hey, I like to think our commentary has gotten better as we've matured with the podcast.
Yeah, I would agree with that. Initially, we really didn't know what we were doing.
No.
Yeah.
Did you ever go back and listen to those? Yikes!
No, no, I, I stopped after a while, you know. And I used to actually listen to them like the next day to see how it sounded, you know, like the quarterback, you know, day after you sit on a bag of ice and look at the
game. So you stay sharp. No, I'll still do that. I mean, you know, not a lot, but listen to your own podcast. That's sick.
Sick.
But yeah. Yeah.
100
in. Ever thought about, yeah. Have you ever thought about ending it? As your son gets older?
No, actually, this is getting easier as he's gotten older. When he was first born, and I was just like, I can't do anything. I need to help my wife with the baby, because he was, you know, when they're little, they're so needy. And they just, you know, I didn't want to commit to sitting down here for an hour and talking.
Yeah. If, that like, was right the only now, time I really thought that I was like, I don't know if we can do this anymore. And I was like, because you were like, okay, you know, you have to do it. I'm like, yeah, I can do that. And then I sat down like, I cannot do this by myself. So I had to call Greg. I was like, Greg, I need you to talk to me about this movie.
You know, I can't imagine doing this solo. I have to do the intro sometimes a couple of times before I get it right, because it's just yammering to nobody.
Yeah.
And I don't get guys who can sit there in a room alone and just yap and not say too many times.
Well, like, I was going to do that. And I made a list of things I was going to talk about for, I think it was like the Turtles movie. And I sat down and I looked at it like, this is like listening to someone read their grocery list. Like, why would I do this? Yeah. I have nothing to play off of.
No, it doesn't really make up. Like, even if, like, I've heard some podcasts where like one guy is talking a lot and the other guy he's just there. He's maybe contributing a question or two here and there. And, you know, usually it's about politics and they're expanding about philosophy. But the person's talking to someone, that always sort of makes it easier on the speaker just to have a warm body in the room to be looking at you while you do it. Otherwise, you know, it's just sort of oral masturbation at that point.
Yeah.
But no, I think that, you know, it's gotten easier as my son's gotten older. Like today, he got his last round of vaccinations 2 days ago. And he was home with me all day today because he had a fever of 102 when he woke up. If he had had a fever of 102 a year ago, there's no way I would have been able to sit down here and do a podcast with you, because my brain would have been A, half fried, because I'd be freaking out that he was sick, you know, and B, I'd be so tired from having dealt with him all day that I wouldn't have had the energy. But now it's like, yeah, like with anything, you get better at parenting, you know, he was only at 102 because he had the vaccination, and now that's over and he's asleep and he's just fine and I can focus on this. It's not a big deal. So when we have another baby, we'll see about that.
Yeah, I'm sure there can be a hiatus. That's fine.
Yeah. But yeah, that's, I mean, it's funny because like when you're not a parent yet and you're going to be, you're just thinking like, yeah, I think I can do this. I have no idea how, but I think I can. And then when you have the baby and you get good at it, you then are convinced beyond a shadow of a doubt that there's no way you could do this with another kid at the same time. It's like, yeah. I can't. That's two of them? You want me to take care of two of them?
Yeah.
Simultaneously?
They'll get old and then they'll be like, Dad, I don't want to play with you anymore. You're like, okay.
Well, yeah. Which you wonder when, like, which is the worst thing? Like, we went through a phase recently with my son at daycare. We would drop him off and he'd freak out. He would cry and scream. He wouldn't let us go, kind of thing. And then one day we went in and it was fine. We would get to the door of the room and he would jump out of my arms and go play. And I'd be like, all right, see ya.
Well, okay.
And then kind of like, I didn't want him to freak out, but I wanted some acknowledgement that I was departing and he was going to be by, you know, with these people without maybe me for 6 hours.
Maybe I'll never come back. You don't know. If you had a dog, the dog would be worried.
Yeah.
Every time you go to get the mail, the dog was like, is he coming back? Maybe by episode 500, he won't have to worry about it anymore.
Yeah. Although it's what was interesting was that, you know, when our father passed away, our mother told me to go and get. She had a voicemail message from him that she had saved on her phone, and she's like, "Can we get this off and save it somehow?" And I was like, "Yeah, I can look into that." And I found a company that you go online, you pay them, I don't know, $25 or something or something like that. You give them access to your voicemail, and they download the message as an MP3, and they mail it to you, or email it to you. So I did that, and we have that. But so long as, you know, the cloud doesn't come crashing down with the zombie apocalypse, there is a rather, as long as we keep paying Amazon the $4.85 they ask for us every month to store this stuff on their servers, you know, there's a rather large record of, you know, our conversations available to our children. You know, granted, they're laced with profanity, but they're there.
Well, it's the God's honest truth, I suppose.
That's, you know, that's probably true.
Sorry, everybody. Sorry, future kids.
I love you guys.
Yeah. See this movie.
Probably go rent it on that thing that they beam it into your brain with now.
Yeah. Weird.
So
yeah, no, I'm looking forward to doing another 100. I don't see why not.
Sure. Which is pretty much how this whole thing began. I don't see why not.
Yeah, no, I don't see why not. You know, no pressure. And I know our buddy Greg had joined a podcast network for a while, and you know, like they had like production schedules and things like that. And I like that we just have a very loose format where it's like, we haven't done anything in 2-3 weeks. Yeah, that's fine. We'll get to it.
Yeah. Yeah. And I do like to, you know, keep things relatively fresh, you know, on a weekly basis. But like, if nothing comes out, and if, you know, if I get sick, and then my kid gets sick and something else, like, you know, can't do it this week. Sorry. Yeah. It's just,
yeah.
But hang in there, guys. We haven't gone anywhere. We'll let you know if things change for the worse.
That's true. I don't want to. I listened to a podcast once with Chris Hardwick. He was talking to the girl from Churches, the Scottish girl. She sounds like Scrooge McDuck. It's great. I love it. And it's just like her. She's in Churches, and that's like the third band she's ever been in that's like half successful. And this one is the first one that's really successful now. And the way she kept talking was like, you know, as long as the band is together, we'll put out more albums. And if the band is together, and she said it like 30 times, and finally I was wondering it too. And he finally said it, like, do you not expect the band to be together? Or like, you know, what's the deal with it? Why do you keep saying it that way? She was like, I've been in band since I was in high school. Like when I turned 15, I joined a band. She goes, they never stayed together. You know, it's like the summer of 69 over here. Like they just break up. People go off on their way. She's like, so I'm just going to enjoy it as long as it goes. And then if it doesn't, I'll let you know. And we'll be like, well, we're breaking up. She goes, and I'll find another band.
Yeah.
And he was like, oh. She's like, well, that's a remarkably, you know, simple way of looking at it, I guess. And she goes, yeah, just being realistic. Oh, okay. So, yeah, we'll let you know. But we'll keep trucking until then. Yeah. So.
If you have anything that you want to share about your experiences listening to us, thoughts that you have, comments, questions, concerns, if you're looking for nude photos of Phil, you can tweet us at 3DrinksInPod. That's at the number 3DrinksInPod. Instagram and Facebook are 3DrinksInPodcast. All no one word.
No one's looking for those.
No, not really.
Sorry.
Not actively, at least. Email us at 3DrinksInPodcast@gmail.com. And don't forget to go to iTunes, Google Play, Stitcher, and tune in. Subscribe to the podcast so you never miss an episode. And we can count you as one of our loyal subscribers. And leave us that rating and review. We really appreciate that, 100 of them. And we have a few on iTunes. We could do it some more. And just to, you know, give our egos a boost. And if you don't think we need that or deserve that, forget I said anything.
You're sorely mistaken, because I do need that. I'm very fragile.
It's like the Daryl Strawberry on The Simpsons.
Yeah.
These guys are professional athletes. It doesn't bother them.
It rolls right off their backs.
All right, everybody. Anything else?
Okay. No, that's it.
All right. As always, please drink responsibly.
See you next time.
See you next time.
Who knows what adventures they'll have between now and the time the show becomes unprofitable. I'm Troy McClure, and I'll leave you with what we all came here to see: hardcore nudity!